I'm Verna Avery Brown. You're listening to Peace Watch. Jay Winter Nightwolf is a member of the Buffalo Ridge Cherokee people and is the host of the Nightwolf Talk Show on WPFW in Washington, D.C. He has strong feelings about this holiday. Celebrated by Americans as a holiday, it's a national day of mourning, he says, for indigenous people.
Peace, a rare and elusive flower, continues to be overlooked, if not intentionally avoided, by the political managers of industrial interests. Economic interest has always been the tail that makes the kite of profit fly. It was seen attached to Columbus on his maiden voyage as he stumbled into a world and a way of life that would forever be changed or mangled, depending on your point of view. It was attached to revolution in 1776, and it was seen flying during Western expansion or invasion, depending on your point of view. It was attached to George Washington's invasion of Iroquois after success seemed imminent against his fellow Britons. It was attached to the Manations and ploys to engage Native people in their loss of what was called the Old Northwest with William Henry Harrison, in the South with Andrew Jackson and Indian removal, Sam Houston in Texas, Abraham Lincoln in Gettysburg, and Teddy Roosevelt in Cuba. The tail on this kite is so long, it seems improbable that it can still find enough air to get airborne. But there is enough hot air in Washington to float the industrial banner by finding another reason to pursue new frontiers on which to wage war and economic exploitations. The flower of peace was plucked from the American soil by Christopher Columbus when he opened the door to Spanish, French, Dutch, Swiss, and English invaders, colonizers, pirates, slavers, murderers, rapists, thieves, and imperialism. He ushered in systematic extermination and wholesale slaughter, starting with the Carib and the Taino people by fire, steel, torture, religion, and trained dogs. Thousands were literally worked to death as slaves, and untold thousands wiped out by measles, diphtheria, pox, and other European diseases to which the indigenous people had no resistance. The destruction of cultural dynamics, the loss of core confidence in long-term social norms resulting from the mortality of leaders, elders, and parents made conventional understanding for the indigenous people unfathomable, leaving them vulnerable to transculturation, which was and is effectively and methodically imposed by the invaders. Disease caused discontinuity and biological culture shock with immediate and long-term effects to this day. The methodology employed against the indigenous people of the Americas 450 years ago would be given a name by Raphael Lemkin, and that name is genocide. Columbus inaugurated the depopulation of the Americas, which would later in years be described as conquest and ultimately give birth to the phrase manifest destiny. Columbus became to his welcoming host a rapacious pirate and despot. For these reasons, the indigenous people observe October 12, 1492 as a day worthy only of mourning. Can we take just a little time and effort to find the flower of peace before we further explore Iraq? For we have enough history of war to tell us that it has not solved man's problems, not in the past, and conceivably not in the future. I'm Jay Winter Nightwolf. Thank you.
Nightwolf is a member of the Buffalo Ridge Cherokee people and host of WPFW's Nightwolf Talk Show. Since 1996, the Chicago-based peace organization Voices in the Wilderness has been sponsoring trips to Iraq by U.S. and British citizens in defiance of United Nations sanctions and U.S. foreign policy. Recently, the group's coordinator, Kathy Kelly, sent a proposal to the Iraqi government asking that American volunteers be allowed to take up residence in Baghdad and other Iraqi cities in order to hold peace vigils and position themselves at sites such as water treatment and electrical facilities should the U.S. launch a full-scale military attack on the country. Speaking recently in Boston, Kelly said a war on Iraq would compound the misery of a people already suffering from years of economic sanctions, and she criticized the way the Bush administration has marketed the war as just another consumer product.
Now comes Mr. Andrew Card to tell us in early September that everybody knows you never market a new product in August. I was horrified by that line because it's so clear that the United States is trying to sell a war. It might mean calibrating the clock. It might mean deciding that we're going to go good cop this week and bad cop next week. It might mean trying to sell it at one particular week to the United Nations Security Council through extortion and bribery as well. It might mean another week trying to sell it to the U.S. public. But the think tankers are together and they're working hard round the clock. They're very bright. They're enormously resourceful. They have enormous resources. And Mr. Card assures us that even if in August the plans seem to be all over the map, don't worry. Everybody knows you never market a new product in August. How conveniently he forgot August 6th, August 9th, and may we add now August 2nd, when the economic sanctions against Iraq were first imposed. And those economic sanctions now being a different kind of warfare, but the warfare against Iraq never ended. It changed into an economic warfare that has been a discriminate form of warfare, directly discriminating against the most vulnerable people in that society, the elderly, the sick, the poor. And then at a magnitude which, with 16 visits, I still can't wrap my own mind around, the children. And I ask myself again and again and again, what possible crime did any one of those children commit? And I say to myself, I'm more responsible for Saddam Hussein than any one of these children. I've lived in the country that's lived well and benefited because the United States has been able to control the flow of petrodollars and control the recycling of those petrodollars back into our economy. I can feel their bony and bird-like little bodies. I can hear their gasps still. And when I see that the New York Times Magazine speaks about Mr. Wolfowitz saying that Saddam Hussein is so cruel that he will watch a child being tortured in front of that child's parents, and then when I see that that's the line that Mr. Bush brought before the United Nations, point at Saddam Hussein, vilify Saddam Hussein, look at Saddam Hussein, well, look at Kathy Kelly. Because I sat next to mothers hundreds of times now in hospitals across Iraq, sat next to them while their children died pitiable, tortuous, gruesome deaths. And I murmured, Ana Asifa, Ana Asifa. I'm sorry. We can't allow the fear-mongerers to orchestrate us into creating catastrophe, a horrible precedent, the miseries and the woes of bombardment on top of what people have already suffered in a beleaguered and unfairly, ungodly punished country. When I was in Iraq in December, January, I was there during a holiday time. It was the end of Ramadan. It was the beginning of the Christmas season and the New Year. And okay, I'll do just about anything to miss the Christmas season in this country, but so don't feel bad for me. But I said to some of the Iraqi doctors that we know at a hospital called the Al-Mansur Children's Wing of the Saddam Hussein Teaching Hospital, can I just sort of get to know a couple of families and maybe make myself useful, but go back and forth and visit during this holiday season? They said, yes, you are welcome, Kathy. Yes, do that. So I did get to know a few of the families, and I was in a cancer ward, and yes, people don't bring their children to cancer wards when they're healthy, I know. The doctors there have been pretty valiant and heroic in my mind. They have known how to cure childhood cancers, but their charts say again and again and again, N-A, the ominous N-A, it means not available. Maybe everything else is in line to be able to bring a child into remission from leukemia, but miss one drug, and that child's chances are gone. Well, the first day that I had gone with some of my companions, Teresa Kubasik had little tiny plastic harmonicas to pass out to children in the ward, and they were a big hit, cost about 5 cents apiece. But one little boy had just had a splenectomy, and also not available was adequate anesthetic, and he was in a world of pain. His name was Muntadar. It means waiting for. And little Muntadar's mother and sister were quite eager to be distracted in the course of the day and talk to us. And I learned that they couldn't even call their relatives in Amara because they didn't have enough money to make a phone call to let them know that Muntadar wouldn't be going home anytime soon, that the doctors seemed to think that this was a pretty serious diagnosis. And what the doctors had told us, but not the mother and aunt, was that Muntadar also had cancer. And so we managed to work it out that we could donate blood specifically for him. And there was a lot of esprit de corps going on. I was very happy to go back another day and meet with them. And I had a coloring book this time. And Muntadar felt better. And he undertook what many have undertook, teaching me some Arabic words. And that had a short duration because they give up, understandably. But it was a good way to build relationships. And then the third time I went back, I felt a little bit proud because the mother said that Muntadar had been asking for me every day, where is Kathy? And he reached out his arms and gave me a kiss on the cheek. And then he hugged his mother and he asked her, whispered, does she have a harmonica for me? Well, little Muntadar had not missed the fact that every other kid got one little, dug in the pocket of my coat, and thank goodness there was one last little harmonica, which I was only too happy to give to him. And he clutched it and just beamed. And the next time I went back, the bed sheets were turned back, and Muntadar died on January 5th, 2002. Mothers in the hospitals have taught us not to express intense grief and emotion. It scares the other children. It raises anxiety. Doctors tell us, really, we are now more like social workers and psychiatrists. First, we help the children to get ready for the deaths of the other children in the ward, and then to prepare for their own deaths. And so I swallowed the lump. And later that night, I was at the Baghdad Symphony Orchestra, another place where you will see people of great valiance, and Nabil would, I know, agree that these are the people who, even though they can't always get the reeds or the grease or the strings or the keys to repair instruments, which under this long set of years of embargo, you know, they need repair from time to time, and they certainly can't get new ones into the country, and the existence of an instrument is so precious that you can't get one out of the country. And they don't always have sheet music, and yet they get together every Friday night, these musicians, and they do their best to make music. And I'm very, very impressed by them. It doesn't always sound like the Western composition that they're playing with, which we're familiar, but they're in there together to try to preserve a sense of that tremendous dignity which this country represents. So as the lights went down in a darkened auditorium, then I cried for Muntadar. But of course, not just for Muntadar. Lost to all of us are the hundreds of thousands of little lives, children under age 5, snuffed out by a policy which will be, I feel sure, in history, one of the lessons for how abysmally failed a policy can be and secretly shrouded. Little Muntadar, with his love for music, could have been part of that Baghdad Symphony Orchestra. So I cried those tears for Muntadar, but I also had to realize, all right, be realistic. You've got to see some children that aren't suffering, or there was a chance I might snap. So I said, look, could I go someplace where the kids are kind of healthy? And I'm lucky. We know some awfully good people over there, and they worked it out so that I think within 2 days, I was at the Baghdad School of Folk Music and Ballet, and it's sort of like the
ultimate magnet school in Baghdad, I guess, and it's where I think some of the more well-to-do people, or formerly well-to-do people, send their kids. And you can tell, those of you who are educators, when you're in a school that works. There was grass in front, for one thing. But the kids were just romping, and they were learning cultural history. They were singing. They were dancing. Some of them were learning instruments. And this was great. I walked along with a group of children, and we walked up to, you know, your standard elementary school art exhibit, and I started to nod and smile, and then I clutched. Because exhibited was a child's drawing done in magic marker and pastels of a jumbo passenger jet plowing into the World Trade Center. And I thought, did the child who made that rendition think bullseye? So I asked the children, do you think I could talk to the person who made that drawing? And they were very excited. And they, within minutes, had found Al-Hussein, 11-year-old Al-Hussein. And his shoulders were squared. He was puffed up like a peacock, so proud that the American was interested in his picture. And so I asked him, could you tell me, what were you thinking when you drew that? No hesitation. Allah wanted this to happen to people min America, so people min America understand what happens to people in other countries when America hit them. And then he saw that his teacher had sidled up, and he said, and we love the people min America, and we want to be their friend. Well, goodbye heart. So I felt that it was important for me to tell him and his friends right there that I had been in New York City on September 11th, and that when standing on a rooftop quite safe in a parish in Brooklyn, I saw the smoke billowing over the city. I had thought to myself that among the people who could best understand the agony, the pain, the loss, the arms aching for loved ones that will never return, would be the people I'd met again and again in Iraq. And I wanted them to know that there had been some extraordinary people in the United States who very quickly, after they buried their loved ones, had in fact made statements in writing, basically to say, our grief is not a cry for war.
Kathy Kelly of Voices in the Wilderness. Special thanks to Dave Goodman of the Boston Community Reporters Project for recording that speech. Free Speech Radio News reporter Josh Chaffin has been thinking a lot about the relationship between government and the media in times of war.
I changed the startup sound on my computer the other day. You know, the sound that your computer makes when you start it up, that first little sound? I found the appropriate menu in the control panels of my machine, and I installed a 9-second-long digital audio file that I made myself. It'll replace that soaring sound that you probably have on your computer. Yeah, well, I'm done. I'm through with that sound. Every morning from now on, when I come into work, I'll hear the voice of a slightly annoyed Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld.
I really do think that it's a mistake for the press and the media to focus excessively on this one subject.
I'm a reporter, and I find that sound inspiring. I found it in a tape I'd made for a radio news story on Iraq. Iraq is the subject Rumsfeld refers to. Secretary Rumsfeld was tired of reporters' questions on Iraq. One of my fellow reporters reminded Mr. Rumsfeld that his boss, the president, had been talking about Iraq nonstop for months, and that it's only natural reporters would try to squeeze some of the details out of the man who is, after all, the Secretary of Defense. We needed then, and we need now, a national dialogue on this issue. Both houses of Congress have just voted to support the use of force on Iraq. The White House wanted the permission to go to war, and the White House got it. And here's a servant of the people, the Secretary of Defense, telling reporters whose job it is to inform the people not to look into the issue. Now, since when is it a public official's job to tell reporters what to write about? Or even worse, what not to write about? Maybe the secretary was tired of reporters pointing out facts on Iraq that have to do directly with him, that he was a Middle East envoy in the Reagan years, and that he met with Saddam Hussein on friendly terms, Mr. Rumsfeld was actually in Baghdad on the day the United Nations first reported that the Iraqis had used chemical weapons, and later it came out the U.S. helped Iraq plan and execute chemical attacks on Iran. The U.S. gave Iraq the seed stock to make those chemical weapons during the Reagan years when Mr. Rumsfeld was a Mideast envoy. What about the story that in the hours after the September 11th attacks, Secretary Rumsfeld suggested to his staff the U.S. should immediately attack Iraq, whether or not Iraq was to blame?
I really do think that it's a mistake for the press and the media to focus excessively on this one subject.
Now, the Secretary of Defense is a man who knows reporters very well. He's in front of the media constantly. He knows if he tells us not to look into something, then we're gonna look into it. I mean, the press has pretty much stopped covering things like corporate scandal, the environment, the economy, because we're all focused on Iraq. And I think most people would agree those are issues that are important. So I guess I agree with the Secretary of Defense when he says that reporters are focusing too much on Iraq. The problem is he and the rest of the administration keep trying to make a war over there.
Free Speech Radio news reporter Josh Chaffin. DeBaum, a producer in Denver, Colorado, brings us this sound collage titled Columbush.
Young people should stand up for the rights of citizens and do what they believe.
Answer.
That's how the country operates.
Violence is not the answer.
To prevent war with Iraq. They should have been doing this when they were making war on our people and obliterating our people and taking our resources. They based the Constitution on the great law of peace, the Iroquois Confederacy, but they didn't follow the principles that the great law of peace follows. And it says all men are created equal. But according to the United States Constitution, that doesn't mean the red man, the brown man, the black man, or the poor man, or any women. What they're talking about is all rich men are created equal, or all noblemen are created equal. And I think that's how they interpreted it.
Imperialist policies that began when they got here and landed at Plymouth Rock. It's not changed a bit. Expansion all the way across. The earth is round. They ran out of places to go, and now they're looking for places to take more from. It's about money, power, and control. It's about greed. The corruption of extreme greed. That's what it's really about. That's what they're all about. So all of them have been fights over territory and what's in the land. Whether it's minerals or oil or what the land will grow. Bananas in Central America, coffee, can't make any difference. These people just don't have any end to their greed. They will never be satisfied, never. You need to bring them under control. Any control needs to be done. The masses of the people need to control the corporate capitalist class because they're really out of hand now. Been like running rabshot over everybody.
The genocidal policies of the United States government is still continuing and it's going worldwide.
Bush is the new Columbus, and globalization and the whole routine that he has developing for Iraq, the war on terrorism. Indigenous people are accustomed to being labeled as terrorists, whether foreign or domestic. And so we see this as an extension of the plan that Columbus began in 1492. So it's encouraging to see all these people out here saying that we're drawing a line against that kind of policy, globalization and oppression, the hierarchy of Rich against poor. North against south.
You've been listening to Imperatives for Peace, Pacifica's Peace Watch. Our producer is Scott Gurian. Tonight's engineer was Rolando Arrieta. Our editor is Reem Kathuda at WPFW. Our associate producers are Fidel Rodriguez of KPFK and Robert Knight of WBAI. Sam Husseini and Larry Binsky are consultants to the program. We have production assistance from Sidrak Franklin and Laurel Paget-Seekins at WPFW. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Thank you for listening.
Well, this war is about what it's always been about who's in the way. Who's in the way of capitalist expansion? Who's in the way of the New World Order? In 1492, Columbus represented the New World Order. In 2002, Bush represents the New World Order.